Good evening. So glad that you're here. We are all regularly inspired by the work of some of our contemporary saints. Mother Teresa for her work with the poor and dying in Calcutta. Martin Luther King Jr. for his vision of a world of peace and justice and equality. Bill McKibben for his prophetic words and actions about the future of the planet. And this last week, three such individuals were here in Minneapolis for the Nobel Peace Prize Forum. Lema Bowie, whose activism brought peace to Liberia. The Dalai Lama, who has inspired millions with his message of mindfulness and compassion. And Sister Helen Prejean, who has done so much to move America out of the undistinguished company of countries that still practice capital punishment: Iraq, Iran, Sudan, China, Somalia, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. It is right that we admire these giants, but our admiration is stillborn unless it breathes in the life of our own commitments and action. When we hear about the great individuals who do such stunning work, the proper response is to ask, what can I do? What can my mosque, my synagogue, my church do? Our topic for tonight's session flows from those very questions. All of us on the panel and many of you in the room come from communities of faith or communities of conviction that have been claimed by some vision of social justice. But given the popular perception that religions and religious people have caused as much conflict in the world as they have settled, it is eminently appropriate for us to ask ourselves how religious communities might bend the arc of history toward justice. Out of our varied religious traditions, what unified voice or disparate voices can we raise that might bring the world closer to our vision of a peaceable kingdom? Let me introduce our panel. First, we have Reverend David Breeden from the First Unitarian Society of Minnesota. David's second here in line. Then we have Imam Makram El Amin, who is the spiritual leader at Masjid An-Nur on Minneapolis North Side. Third, you already met the Reverend Dan Collison, who is at First Covenant Church in East Downtown. Marcia Zimmerman, sitting among us, who is the senior rabbi at Temple Israel, incidentally, one of the largest Reform congregations in all of American Judaism. After each of these individuals has made a brief presentation, there will be responses from two of our group: Reverend Tim Hart Anderson, who is senior pastor at Westminster Presbyterian Church, and Father Michael O'Connell, who is the pastor of the Church of the Ascension. A caveat here. Each of us would want you to know that while we speak out of our traditions, we do not necessarily speak for our traditions, and we certainly do not speak for every individual in our traditions. At the end of these presentations and responses, we will look to you for questions, either questions for information or clarification, or questions of dissent or comments of dissent. The ways in which you can make those known are to write them on the cards that you were given when you came in tonight, and someone will pass among you and collect these as the evening is going on. Or you can come right down to one of the mics down front here and speak your question aloud. Or you can text your question to the number on the screen. What a brave new world we live in. You know, if it's too much to write it down or come down here, you can actually text it from your phone. It's remarkable. Mm-hmm. We are delighted that you have come to join us in this conversation. We believe, every one of us, that the survival of our planet now calls for and demands civil, loving, and thoughtful interfaith, multi-faith dialogues. Once again, thanks for being here. And with no further ado, we'll hear from David Breeden.
I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one.
My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends toward justice. Unitarian minister Theodore Parker spoke those words at the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Convention in January of 1858. When Parker spoke, slavery was being defended in the North and the South as condoned by Scripture. Parker's job was to convince people that, despite chapter and verse, conscience, morality changes over time. And that, in 1858, moral, ethical people could not allow slavery to exist. 100 years later, Reverend Martin Luther King, who considered becoming a Unitarian minister and was well-versed in Reverend Parker's anti-slavery activism, repeated Parker's words and improved on them a little bit. Quote, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." King, too, had to convince people that in 1958, moral, ethical people could not allow segregation to exist. Both preachers were out to bend that arc toward justice. It's little wonder then that when President Barack Obama, whose beloved grandmother was Unitarian, had those words woven into the rug in the Oval Office, right, and are still there. And it's also little wonder that President Obama, in his remarks on the death of Nelson Mandela, offered as the highest praise, quote, "He bent the arc of the moral universe toward justice." Inherent in the thought of Reverend Parker long ago, and still the guiding principle of Unitarian Universalist humanists today, is that this world is not as it should be. This world is not just, and it's up to us here now to bend that arc toward justice. You see, humanists do not believe that there is a deity that has a plan or that will come down and set things right here or in the hereafter. Since we do not believe in an ultimate overarching morality inherent in the universe, we believe it's all up to us. This one precious life is what we have, all we have. And every human being everywhere has inherent worth and dignity. Therefore, it is a moral imperative that humanists strive for the greatest good for the greatest number right now. So it is that many humanists gather in congregations, not for worship, not merely for community, but to focus our energies toward bending that arc of the moral universe. Now, not all humanists are Unitarian Universalists, and not all Unitarian Universalists are humanists, nor do I mean to paint a completely rosy picture of humanism. My congregation, First Unitarian Society of Minneapolis, is one of the largest humanist congregations in the United States, and that speaks ill of humanists because we are not a large congregation. There is, for example, a gulf between those who call ourselves religious humanists and those who consider themselves secular humanists. And my congregation is one of the larger humanist congregations because humanists have a tendency to be fractious and holier than thou. Yes, there is a holier than thou humanism. I contend that the best way to define any religious or philosophical position is to find its chief hypocrisy. The hypocrisy of humanism is that there is only one sort of humanism and only one way to be humanist. And I call this attitude humanister than thou. How can you be more agnostic or more atheist? Also, unfortunately, humanist and Unitarian Universalist groups are still predominantly middle class, and Euro-American, with Euro-American social expectations and Euro-American models for fixing problems. In other words, when we put our hands on that arc of the moral universe to bend it, often we have not discussed the matter with those we are trying to help. We assume we know best. We often operate from highly individualist worldviews that make little or no sense to those from a collective worldview. It's egotistical, it's immature, and it severely limits the efficiency and efficacy of our good intentions. Humanists are, for example, strong advocates for reproductive justice. But does reproductive justice among Euro-Americans and reproductive justice among African-Americans operate in the same way? I'm saddened that the social and economic privilege of humanist groups often function as barriers for those who think as we do, but come out of other social locations. The struggle in my ministry is to get humanists past the easy and, dare I say, thoughtless criticism of religions and the religious and other humanists. My hope is that humanists will begin to approach people of other religions in love, not criticism. Perhaps then we will join with all faith traditions in bending that arc toward justice, because we can all agree in this broken world with the words of Dr. Martin Luther King. Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others?
Good evening. It is traditional for Muslims to begin any endeavor with God's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. I'm delighted to be with you this evening. How can religious communities help bend the moral arc of the universe towards justice? Quote, if you see a wrong, change it with your hand. If you're unable to change it with your hand, then change it with your mouth. If you are unable to change it with your mouth, then dislike it in your heart. But know that that is the weakest of faith. Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, may peace be upon him. Social justice is woven into the fabric of Muslim life, according to the above saying of Muhammad. There's a movement, an order of preference when it comes to one's ability to respond to the wrong they see in the world. Change is in your hands. The hands is symbolic for one's ability to physically change or alter the circumstances before them. This is a call to action for the common person of faith to be ready and willing to respond to circumstances that hinder human life from being its best self. Muhammad was speaking of a healthy society, one able to respond to the needs of the people, having the strength, the wherewithal, the resources, and the will to make change for the better. That is the first choice. The power of the tongue. The tongue is a powerful tool. It is a means for the common person to be advocates for change and a voice of reason. It can happen in many ways, speaking truth to power, a political rally or protest, some political discourse, or educating the masses. This is considered on the second tier of responsiveness according to the teachings of Islam when it comes to change. The heart. The heart is the seat of intelligence and sentiment. To simply dislike something that is detestable or wrong in our heart is the last resort of change in Islam. This is for those who are unable to reach the threshold of the first two levels, yet still have an obligation to protest within themselves. and not become detached or complacent. Two core values championed in Islam is justice and working together for the common good of society. Muhammad's emphasis on these values were strong and resonated with the people of Mecca. They served as a driving force for transformation of that society under his leadership. The most basic aim of Islamic law is to establish justice in all affairs. Justice has to flow from all levels of social life, from personal dealings with oneself and others, to public relationships with the community and the state. Today, speaking out against injustice and working for the common good continues to prove a challenging task. It is the work of religious communities to be torchbearers in this regard and to push the envelope. The Quran says, "Surely God doesn't change the condition of a people until they change what is within themselves." Change starts within. This speaks of a strong principle in Islam to take ownership for the life that God has intended for all people. Islam fully embraces the saying, "Be the change you want to see in the world," by the great Mahatma Gandhi. The Quran: cooperate with one another in goodness and God consciousness, and do not cooperate with others in sin and aggression. Muslims are instructed in the Quran to form alliances with others for the promotion of good in the world and all of the world. O you who have faith, be maintainers of justice and bear a witness for God's sake, Allah's sake, though it may be against your own selves or your parents or your nearest relatives, if you be rich or poor. Allah, God, that is near to both in compassion. Therefore, follow not your low desires unless you deviate and you swerve and turn aside. Then surely Allah, God, that is aware of what you do. I do not stand before you this evening suggesting that Muslims are perfect in their behavior. In many cases, our behavior is not congruent with our faith traditions. Whether it be the mistreatment of women by some, the hoarding of wealth by the wealthy in oil-rich countries, or conflicts between cultural practice and religious mandates. However, I am suggesting that when we live according to our best ideals of Islam, we become a community that bends the moral arc of the universe towards justice. Finally, in my conclusion, we are living in a world that is much smaller than it has ever been, not in terms of geography, but in human consciousness. The pressures of life have forced us to come together in a spirit of cooperation for the betterment of us all. This, I believe, is the way God has always intended. Thank you. God's peace.
Well done. It is my distinct pleasure to be with you tonight and provide an evangelical response to today's question. But I face a dilemma in answering this question. I mean, after all, what is an evangelical? The central tenets of evangelicalism are Jesus is God. The Bible is centrally important. Spiritual awakening is necessary, and Christian mission is a global pursuit. But that said, I struggle to tell you who is an evangelical. I mean, is an evangelical Rob Bell, whose teaching reframed evangelical assumptions about the afterlife in generous terms, or is an evangelical John Piper, who teaches that God preordains the eternal suffering of billions of people in a literal hell? Is an evangelical politician Michelle Bachmann, who makes sweeping public attacks against such religions as Islam and is opposed to the rights of gay people? Or is an evangelical Rachel Held Evans, who is a famous blogger known for challenging misogyny within Christian religion and who works alongside Justin Lee, the founder of the Gay Christian Network, who is this tireless advocate on behalf of those who consider themselves LGBT. I mean, I could go on. Are evangelicals televangelists, such as Robert Tilton, known for bilking millions of dollars from vulnerable people? Or are they modern-day monastics, such as Shane Claiborne, who began a movement of Christians into impoverished urban centers to live alongside and serve under-resourced people? I mean, it seems ridiculous to lump all of these personalities into a single religious category. And yet that's exactly what has happened in 21st century America. Perhaps this is the burden of a large framework religious tradition that has evolved uncontrollably in an entrepreneurial and free society. Or perhaps evangelicalism is like, it's like the Palm Pilot, which invented an entirely new recognizable brand with wide, broad spiritual appeal. Now, one thing is clear, evangelicalism is going through incredible transition, and segments of this movement will die the way the Palm Pilot did, a victim of its own limited operating system. But there are segments of evangelicalism that are acquiring new operating systems and are growing in completely new directions, including those catalyzed by today's topic, the life-giving work of social justice. Mm-hmm. Now, this emphasis on social justice is a new trend within modern evangelicalism, and by and large, I believe, personally, evangelicalism is still more defined by its ideological moralisms than by its commitments to Jesus' teachings specifically. And not the least of which, that greatest commandment to love God and to love neighbor as yourself. And if social justice is to become a core value of evangelicalism, I believe it will require a completely new imagination that shifts majority thinking not only from institutional retrenchment to human flourishing, but also from coercive proselytizing to holistic Christian witness. I mean, I believe those are the two major blind spots of evangelicalism that limit its ability to participate with others in bending the moral arc of the universe toward justice. It's institutional retrenchment and coercive proselytizing. Now, when I hear the word blind spot, my mind immediately returns to the first time I heard my mother scream it at the top of her lungs, "Dan, there's a car in your blind spot!" She reached for me. Now, okay, I was a totally inexperienced driver driving a 15-passenger van. I was driving 65 miles an hour on the S-curve. They called it the dangerous S-curve in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I had a habit of steering in whatever direction my head went, in addition to the fact I hadn't taken driver's education, and my last name is one eye short of collision. With those things stacked against me and prompted by my mother's scream, I returned to my lane with adrenaline coursing through my veins. And my racing heart was in no way quieted by the other driver's hand gesture as he passed me. But perhaps that driver didn't realize that I didn't even know that a blind spot existed. Now, my ignorance didn't change the fact that it was my fault for almost causing an accident, but it does show you that blind spots can be as much about lack of education and experience as they are about the cause of accidents. And I believe the same is true for evangelicalism and social justice. The Christ follower's call to social justice is abundantly clear. As recorded in the New Testament Gospel of Luke, Jesus said, "His mission is our mission, and his mission demands concern for the poor, focuses on setting the oppressed free, and comes with the clear message that God loves every single person on the planet." Now, evangelicalism's institutional blind spot is prioritizing boundaries over compassion, mercy, and justice. And its institutionalism says our primary concern is making sure we are right. Human flourishing emphasizes generosity and says with Jesus, our primary concern is making sure we are standing in the right place alongside those who suffer. Evangelicalism's proselytizing blind spot says, our primary concern is pressuring people to convert to Christian religion regardless of the cost of relationships. But holistic Christian witness says, our primary concern is loving others as Jesus loved others, free from coercion and in authentic friendships. God's love with no strings attached. So, what would a new evangelical operating system, which emphasizes human flourishing and holistic Christian witness, bending the arc of justice, look like in the coming years? Well, I believe it would have a vast database of knowledge and celebration of the American Civil Rights Movement, so that evangelicalism would be transformed from a dominantly Caucasian demographic, which has been resistant to racial justice, to a more thoughtful mosaic of people concerned about healing racial histories and forging a multicultural racial future together. But it would also have hundreds of cross-platform applications that directly engage such matters as economic and educational disparities, human dignity and empowerment in employment opportunities, human rights for everyone, environmental stewardship. And it would address such issues as mass incarceration and immigration, all to the degree that we would partner with people and institutions of diverse backgrounds and sharply improve the common good together. And because the Bible is centrally important to this tradition, it would interpret its scriptures with a Jesus-centric set of lenses such that evangelicalism's theology of other would become more generous alongside the many religions and philosophies of the world. The confusion as to who is and who is not evangelical confounds me some days. And yet I find myself in this religious spectrum, perhaps at its edge, because of what I believe about Jesus Christ. Now, there are others with me, and we are leaning into these new points of emphasis flowing from a new operating system. And in it all, we are telling the world that evangelicalism is to be much less concerned about who is and who isn't evangelical, and much more concerned about Christ followers promoting friendship, human flourishing, and embodying the teachings and ethics of Jesus.
In the Torah, which is the five books of Moses, Jacob wrestles with an angel and becomes Israel. In this transformative story, Jacob is a man, but Israel is a people. 4,000 years later, we, the Jewish people, are the direct descendants of Jacob. We are the people who wrestle. We are the people, Israel. It is interesting because the story continues through the book of Genesis and Exodus. We become slaves in Egypt, but God heard our cries and set us free. While this was the first time that the Israelite people who became the Jewish people were isolated and mistrusted and mistreated, it is not the last in our history. Pogroms, the Spanish Inquisition, the Holocaust. Out of the experience within the Torah and all of our experiences historically of anti-Semitism, the Torah impels us to fight for the needy, the oppressed, and the persecuted. 36 times it says in the Torah, welcome the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. As long as the Jewish people are on this earth, we have an imperative to help others in need, to make a difference in the world. That is why 22% of Nobel Peace Prize recipients of chemistry are Jewish. 39% for economics, 27% for medicine, 26% for physics. It is 9% of the total Nobel Peace Prize recipients who are Jews, when we make up a mere 0.2% of the world's population. We have worked to create great strides for the world and humanity, and it dates back to those words 36 times in the Torah. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. Welcome the stranger amongst you. Jews were also central in the civil rights movement. It was people like Rabbi Stephen Wise and so many other Jews who, in collaboration with their African American colleagues, created the NAACP. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who walked hand in hand with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Ralph Abernathy, holding a Torah scroll in this picture, a shared history and experiences of slavery. This is why Rabbi Heschel said at the moment of this photograph, "My feet are praying." Protest is praying. The civil rights of all and fighting for them is praying. We as a Jewish people know what it is to be powerless. We know how to reach out to others who are disenfranchised, to create a power base of activism. But do we as a people truly know or understand what it means to be in a position of power? This is, in my estimation, where our community wrestles with one another and wrestles with God. 66 years ago, 1948, out of the Holocaust came the redemption of the modern state of Israel. Never again would Jews wander from port to port for safety. Here in this picture, the St. Louis is the epitome of what happened. It was filled with Jews from Germany that went from port to port to port, including the United States, and were turned back to the crematoria, to their deaths by the Nazis. The modern state has remained our hope and dream for security and Jewish survival. But there is wrestling we must do as the American Jewish community. There are two narratives of those land, of one land, a Palestinian and Jewish narrative, and it has created a war-torn country. Today we wrestle with how to create peace, a two-state solution. The American Jewish community is not monolithic in its views of Israel, but it is only in recent months and years that the multitude of voices have emerged publicly. Generations X and Y are more comfortable publicly criticizing the Israeli government, and some might even question the power of having a Jewish state. There have been many voices in the political realm as well. The American Israel Policy Action Committee, APAC, has been joined in the Capitol by another group, J Street. Each say that they are there for the love of the State of Israel. APAC, their perspective is that they support the elected Israeli government, and they are there to do that on Capitol Hill. J Street sees that they are to support a point of view, a two-state solution, and that they will criticize the Israeli government if they see an impediment to that end. Ari Shavit's book, My Promised Land, speaks honestly about events long denied. He was just in the Twin Cities yesterday. His book is at the center of a civil discourse within the American Jewish community. And I think, as we learn about events in the past, as we struggle as a community, that we as the American Jewish community will come out stronger, more perhaps nuanced, about always loving and believing in a Jewish state, but being able to see the criticism of policy and the Israeli government. The wrestling we do today will hopefully bring a long-awaited peace tomorrow.
Thanks to our four panelists, wonderful presentations. This is a good time for you to start jotting down your questions or formulating them if you're going to come to a microphone. In the meantime, we'll hear from our two brief responders, Tim Hart Anderson and Michael O'Connell.
First, I want to thank my colleagues for their presentations. Well done. We have conversation like this all the time. It's nice to be able to share the conversation with others. I want to make three points, I think, in response. First is that all of us listening just heard four presentations that said, by and large, the same thing, from different perspectives, perhaps, but by and large said that my tradition, those traditions represented here, have an imperative to look out for the other, to care for the other. They might place it in different theological contexts, but every one of these traditions we're hearing from tonight begins in this question of the bending the arc of the universe toward justice from the concern for the other. Second thing, and that, by the way, I think is very hopeful to hear that from these individuals. Second thing is each one of these traditions we just heard from tonight is willing to be self-critical. And that's not easy to do, especially in a public forum like this. It's much easier to retreat into your tradition and kind of defend it. But I was very pleased to hear each of these speakers, the evangelical Christian, a Jewish rabbi, an imam from the Islamic tradition, and a humanist from the Unitarian tradition, willingly look at themselves and offer some critical perspective. That is the first step we must take if we're going to have genuine multi-faith dialogue, if we're going to figure out how to live in a religiously plural world. We've got to be willing to be self-critical about our own tradition. Now, the Dalai Lama, who was here last week, said, when asked, how do we change the world, he said, change begins with each one of us. And that's, in effect, what we've heard from these traditions. Change for justice begins, in my tradition, by saying, in effect, where have we missed the mark? Hamartia, the Jewish understanding of sin. Where has my tradition gone wrong? And from that perspective, then the dialogue begins. And the third thing I would say is that each one of these traditions spoke about the need for change. I wish we could have heard more specificity about that change, because change for justice, if it's not going to be just charity, it's going to have to involve systemic and political change, and that's controversial for each one of these traditions. And I would challenge my colleagues to go a bit deeper into the question of how each of their traditions has engaged politically for systemic change for justice.
Indeed, it's great to be with all of you tonight, my colleagues. How can religious communities help bend the moral arc of the universe towards justice? Our question, I'd like to companion that with the famous quote from the Hebrew scripture, from Micah. This is what Yahweh asked of you, only this, to act justly, to love tenderly, and to walk humbly with your God. Much of what I have learned as a Catholic priest serving in the greater downtown area of Minneapolis about acting justly, loving tenderly, and walking humbly with God has been learned from the brave and broken, courageously human, inspired and loving leaders of faith gathered here tonight and others over the last 23 years. To act justly, one must act courageously. Marcy Zimmerman challenges us all to understand and defend the legitimacy of the state of Israel, the biblical land of Israel. She bravely challenges her fellow Jews to act justly in defending the rights of the Palestinians. She says from the mandate of Hebrew scripture, and out of the experience of 20 centuries of the Christian oppression of Jews, culminating in the 20th century horror of the Holocaust, she says that Jews themselves today must fight for the needy, the oppressed, and the persecuted in their midst. David Breeden reminds us that the humanist tradition, which partially professes an atheistic point of view, has important legitimacy in the world of those who believe in God and Allah. My understanding and appreciation of the secular and religious humanists I know is their singular focus on preaching and especially doing just living. The world needs this diverse witness, this fundamental moral mandate. I'm so deeply appreciative of Dan Collison's Christian evangelical message. In the midst of the titanic struggle in his own tradition to move towards inclusion in an ever more diverse world and away from an absolutist interpretation of Jesus' message, and calling his people to do the life-giving work of social justice. I'm so appreciative of this because it sounds so much like the message of Pope Francis to the world, especially to the Catholic Church, which also has been so self-absorbed and absolutist. Dan calls all of us away from the orthodoxy of self-absorption and absolutist theology to the universal call acting justly and including all of creation and especially the human part as equally embraced in God's love. Finally, I have learned so much from my friend and neighbor on the north side, Makram El Amin. He speaks of the Muslim symbol of the hand for one's ability to physically change or alter the circumstances of injustice. He goes further to say, this is a call to action for the common person of faith, to be ready and willing to respond to circumstances that hinder human life from being its best self. In a dangerous world where religious ideologies can call us to act without consideration of ours and others' best self, Makram is brave in speaking to his own religious house, as well as ours, to preach and do justice in peace. I'm so grateful for my religious colleagues' just preaching, and more importantly, their tender and humble love as we try together to bend the universe towards justice. I end taking some liberty with a famous quote that I think sums up what we're all trying to say. Let us preach our gospels of justice at all times and use words if necessary.
Lovely, lovely. That's great. It's your turn now. And so I'm going to look for the cards. Are we getting some of those collected? And while we're doing that, I have some questions that came to us from an earlier presentation that I'll just cover these while we're collecting these, because several of the questions asked at one of our earlier presentations had to do with how much diversity, how much breadth of representation is in our group, why in Minneapolis, of all places, is there no Lutheran on the panel tonight, for instance. It's a matter of the luck of the draw, who from our larger group is available on any given night to present, also because the larger Lutheran congregation that is represented in our group right now doesn't have a senior pastor, and so that's been a difficulty as well. But then people have asked, how about Buddhists? How about Hindus? How about agnostics? How about atheists? And some of that is we cover that a little bit with our friend David here. But the fact is, the group has formed over years and is constantly in flux. I think every one of us would hope that in coming years we will be even more inclusive. No one has ever been kept out of this group. It's just the way it's formed. But what I can say about this group is, from the day I arrived 17 years ago in Minneapolis, it has been a place of deep mutual respect and, beyond that, of real love and affection. And I think both Michael and Tim reflected that. We really care about one another, and we care about one another's communities. That's made this collaboration, this group, this friendship so important to us personally, and we hope important to our faith communities as well. So do we have some cards yet? Oh gosh, we got to do better than this. Come on, folks. I mean, not better than this question, but better than one question.
Mm-hmm. It could be a really good question, though.
Yeah.
It could take the whole time.
Okay, this is a good question. Why is organized religion specifically important in this cause? What can organized religion bring to the cause that the merely religious can't? Mm-hmm. We live in an age where the idea of being spiritual but not religious is a very popular idea, and that often implies a kind of individualism. I'm off, I do my own spiritual thing. I don't need or want a community. The panel is challenged to answer what's important about religious communities as opposed to individual religious individuals.
I would say that, you know, we provide a container, and I love the image of a container, because so often individuals think, well, I can just be a good person on my own. And while that is true, at least for Judaism, and I think my colleagues, we have thousands of years of spiritual and justice and work in many areas of practice that we can learn from. Are we perfect? Absolutely not. That's what I love about the five books of Moses, the Torah, is that no one is perfect. We see Moses in all his flaws, and it reflects the real world. You know, far be it from me to say that one's religious stories should somehow reflect perfection, because I think perfection is boring, and I don't think God created it. I think it's wrong, and I think people get into a lot of trouble thinking that they're perfect, thinking they should be perfect, that isn't what we're on this earth to do. We are on this earth to be partners with God and to wrestle, bringing back that wrestling, and to figure out how to heal the wounds. And that, to me, makes us a courageous humanity, and that's what religious traditions help with, and that is the container that I talk.
And I would like to jump on this concept of container, which can sometimes be perceived as a theological construct or an agreed-upon set of values to one tribe or one group. But I think a huge component to why do this within an organized religious community is the actual interaction with live people face to face. The digital age, I believe, has afforded a tremendous amount of disenfranchisement and pulling away from organized religion, because discussion and meaning and experience and video can be captured without having to leave your house. And it can be done in cafes, it can be done with your own cohort, and creating your own tribe separate from religious encumbrances. And I think there's value to that conversation. But what I've even been told by some pretty cutting-edge technologists at the University of Minnesota is you can never replace what happens when you're face-to-face with people
who actually are a little different than you. And this, mm-hmm. I think, is the challenge of religious communities, is to have cultural and groups of people that come together that are truly diverse around those values that you think and you feel close mm-hmm. to you, but you're doing it face-to-face sure. in a group of more than just six people or in a coffee shop, but you've got like 50 people or yeah. you've got 100 people. And as you're bouncing around and talking to each other and engaging some of these conversations, it's just, it behaves very different than if you're by yourself at your computer or if you're with only people who think exactly like you, and it pushes you to see the world in a different way.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dan. Let's see if there's one more response to this, Michael, and then we've got a question over here at the microphone.
I remember years ago a saying that said, when's the last time a TV gave you communion?
Yep.
I think the word communion can be literal, like, you know, the bread and the wine, or it means community. We're radically social beings, and that means that we have a radical hunger to be with each other, and if we're trying to emulate family, and I think that's a pretty fundamental social sociological unit, there's going to be a hopefully some love, some glue of love and persistent love, some forgiving love, some angry love, some caring love. I think those elements are basically fundamentally human. I go with Dan in terms of the danger of thinking that your TV can bring a communion.
Mm-hmm. Jim, can I add sure. one thing that, sure. related to my comment about politics? This is a democracy, and to bring about change in a democracy, the majority rules and changes whatever the unjust laws or situations might be. And one cannot change much if you're on your own in a democracy. You've got to organize politically, you've got to organize people to make change. And these organized communities of believers or good people are a beginning, a stepping off point mm-hmm. to organize political change.
Great, mm-hmm. thanks. Yes.
Hi, my name is Peter Gall. First thing is I'd like to rescue a little bit.
Oh, good.
I'm an ordained member of the ELC, but I've been a chaplain at the Hennepin County Medical Center
great.
For the last 4 years.
Right into the mic. Oh, yeah. Right. There you go.
Much better. There you go.
I'm my name is Peter. I've been a chaplain at UCMC for the last 4 years. I've been ordained in the ELCA. And sort of along the lines of the first responder, I'm just curious to hear a little bit about, in each of your communities, what kind of concrete activities you guys are doing to bend the moral arc. I don't know not all of you have to respond, but maybe just a few.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great.
Well, just to start out, we have a national organization of Unitarian Universalists, and I'm on the committee for social justice within that. The last couple of years, we've been working especially with immigrant rights. We went to Arizona, for example, 2 years ago to march there against the sheriff and that kind of thing. We're now focusing, as I mentioned, on reproductive justice. We think that that's probably been gotten a bit antique in the way that we were dealing with it. We've got a little overconfident about what we had accomplished there. We need to change that conversation. Also, my specific congregation cooperates with this great group of downtown congregations against homelessness. I don't know if you realize that we have one of the lowest homeless populations in the nation because mm-hmm. of this group, right? Yep. So that's not bad.
Maybe yeah. Avenue.
Yes, I'll mention it. What? Here's a concrete example, and I'll say it quickly, and because we want to get more questions, we've got a couple good ones here. A couple of years ago, Kathy Tenbrook, who headed up Minneapolis Office for Ending Homelessness, came to a couple of us and said that there was a problem of overcrowding in one of the shelters on Curry Avenue, and was there anything we could do about it, particularly because many of the people there were eligible for housing somewhere, but they didn't know they were eligible because there were not enough caseworkers to work with them. And what we needed, what she said we needed, was about $350,000 to hire some caseworkers immediately to help with the overcrowding in the Curry Avenue shelters. So a couple of us, actually Tim and I, ended up going on behalf of our larger group to the Downtown Business Council.
Downtown Council.
The Downtown Council, it's called. And what we said was, let's partner between the faith communities and the business community, and let's do this. And we all raised money, the businesses raised money, and together we raised well over $350,000. And as of today, a couple of years later, more than a couple hundred individuals who were in shelters are now in their own housing, being supported by caseworkers, and that work just keeps rolling on. So there's a very concrete example of the way in which communities like this have done some good work. It's a great thing. I should have mentioned also about timing. We're going to go till 8:30, and then we're going to cut it off there. We've got about 20 more minutes. We've got some really good questions here. This is a good one for us all. There are many social justice issues our traditions disagree about. How can we work together on justice at an interfaith level, regardless of some disagreement? Rubber hit road.
You know, I would say that, you know, one of the things that we have done, and I think that it really is a thread that has kind of woven us together, is we have really focused on building relationships with one another. Mm-hmm. And doing so, it allows us to even deal with areas or points by which we might disagree from our traditions about something, and it keeps us at the table. It doesn't allow us to push back from the table. And that's really one of the commitments that we have with one another, is that we really work very hard, very diligently, though we've had opportunities to do so, but we to not push back when things are difficult or we have some difference in terms of how we view or see. We're very respectful of each other. There's no conversion going on around here. In mm-hmm. fact, we're richer. I'm a richer Muslim by my interaction with all of my friends and colleagues here. So I think that there's a space that allows us to be as authentic as we are, as we should be, to our religious tradition. And there's a bridge that allows us to connect on areas we have commonalities, and we keep those boundaries with one another mm-hmm. in a very healthy way. So I think that's really a way to do that. It's not an all or nothing proposition right. in this work. If that be the case, you know, none of us probably wouldn't be here tonight.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I can speak to the matter with the most contentious current topic, being that of gay rights and gay marriage, human sexuality, which in our spectrum, in the evangelical spectrum, is all over the map. My citation of different personalities is accurate. You have some who are for gay marriage, you have some who think it's an abomination in the same, what you would call, framework. Well, the gift that has happened at this table is to actually open up the conversation, talk about how our communities of faith are talking about it, talk about how the broader communities, for instance, Rabbi represents the Reform tradition, but there's also conservative and there's Orthodox Jewish traditions. We talk about intra-faith perspectives, and so there's this roundtable sense of how do we work on this. Now, because we're in Minneapolis, there's a very high consciousness to the human sexuality conversation, mm-hmm. and so I believe the sentimentality of the group tends to lean mm-hmm. towards a learning posture, understanding, mm-hmm. and there's an engagement in our communities of faith that is probably at a deeper level than other places around the country mm-hmm. and the world. And yet, I want to say it's the learning that has been transformative, and while it maybe won't backflow to the various intra-faith traditions or people in evangelicalism, necessarily at this time, it is one that is transformational and helps us to understand the identity of people. You know, First Covenant Church, it affected how we include and frame community to include gay people. There was a real change that took place. At the same time, trying to create the conversation in a way that it remains continually open and continually processing, because such times of incredible social change require courage and thoughtfulness, but always, in my opinion, trying to create bridges
so that it's not an end conversation. Like, it's not done, it's not stake in the ground, it's an open conversation. Mm-hmm. So in my tradition, discerning what we feel God is saying and what the community is saying.
There's also the case of some of our traditions don't support us personally. For example, Father Mike's tradition teaches radical redistribution of wealth as a social policy. Well, my tradition, being largely middle class, doesn't like taxes all that much and doesn't support that. But, you know, so I'm closer to him on that kind of redistributive justice than I am with my own tradition.
I don't want to sit here and say all Catholics.
yeah. That's in the back of the book, right?
Well, one of the reasons we call ourselves Catholic, I think, is that there's such a wide, incredible point of view about various things that, you know, I feel with this group here that I can always hear anything they have to say that may be in dispute with some official teaching of the Catholic Church. Abortion, for instance. That's a very hard one, reproductive rights. It's, you know, there aren't a lot of people, it's a very volatile issue in the culture today. But I feel as if, I feel safe knowing the difference that we have in that here. I can have that, and it can be sharp, and it can be challenging, but I can have it with any of these people. And that's why I welcome that, along with ordination of women, married people, being ordained, you know, this whole incredible situation with clergy sex abuse. I feel safe with these people, and I'm glad I have these relationships, and I'm glad they can feel honest and talk to me about them, because we do work on these relationships.
I think I should also just comment, because Israel is a disputed issue among us. And part of what we did is we actually, several years ago in 2007, journeyed to Jerusalem, the Upper Galilee, and Bethlehem. And so we were courageous in going and doing that with many different perspectives. There are a lot of different denominational and religious points of view about Israel, and we have brought one another to public forums about that for our congregations and for our denominations, and have in many ways opened doors for myself as a Jew to speak to people who support BDS and other things to give my point of view, and that often I am asked to be at the table in order to give that point of view. Even if my colleagues don't agree with it, they make sure my point of view is present. Those are the kinds of things that happen that are in many ways courageous on all of our parts, but more importantly, we are struggling with those things and wrestling with them here. And sometimes I get pushed, and sometimes I push back. And so these are the kinds of things that create friendships, and in many ways, I think we often feel closer to each other and know more about our families than my rabbinic colleagues might know about me, or other colleagues, not who work with me, of course, but in other congregations, because we make a commitment to be at the table once a month for a breakfast where we talk about lots of different things. So those are the kinds of things.
We have a question here about whether there will be any joint projects with the St. Paul Interfaith Network. Any reason why we can't all come together, why we can come together but not cross the river? I mean, this is radical. I feel like I could be friends with a Muslim or a Jew, but somebody from St. Paul, I'm not so sure.
They're so different.
The obvious answer to that is, why would we do that?
Yes.
Where is St. people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you get a little bit of the flavor of the humor, which is another way we get through some of our disagreements, as we're able to joke with one another.
Can I just say
yeah, please do. Yeah.
I would say that, you know, we should be careful in not or thinking that, you know, because there are multiple efforts, that there's some way there may be in conflict with one another, that sort of thing. Because that's really not the case. I mean, it's so much work, it's so much opportunity, so many challenges, that one effort couldn't possibly really address all of them. I think our primary concern was coming even more so than before we could get into, you know, affordable housing or homelessness or anything like that, was really to build in relationship to one another. And I think that is the common denominator and allows us to really, other things to spring forth from out of this synergy that we create with one another. But it's not a conflict. And believe me, there's enough room, enough work
for all of us to
occupy the space.
I'll throw an add to that, Jim. Really? Not only the St. Paul Interfaith Network, which is a great organization, but the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, another terrific interfaith effort that's working in the state capitol to bring justice. There are lots of ways this dialogue is happening in the community.
Right.
Our way has been relational and personal.
And geographic. Mm-hmm. And
geographic. And it's geographically contained to more or less downtown Minneapolis.
Right. Here's a good one. This gets a little more introspective for those of us who serve the way we do. For all the panelists, when your conscience calls you to challenge others, how do you discern whether you are ultimately acting in line with justice?
You know, I love this idea of the world of clergy is changing. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was being a sage from the stage. Mm-hmm. You know, pontificating, telling everybody, and people listen. Today, it doesn't quite work that way. We're sort of guides on the side, and it's a different world in some ways. Yes, we have to say what we believe from the pulpit, but there's a lot of sort of community organizing that gets done in our congregations to move people and to make sure. I thought you were going to ask when our conscience is not in line with our communities and what you do with that. Which I think is a more difficult issue.
Sure.
When you know it's not going to be received well. Mm-hmm. How do we work with that? I guess those are my.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to take a stab at that?
I think of Matthew 25 in our tradition, where it's the final judgment, the scene of the final judgment. There's a separation happening between those who are just and those who are unjust, and the test is always what have you done for the least of these?
Right.
So that seems to me is a good way to test whether a position or posture we're taking toward a particular issue reflects justice and our understanding of it or not what is it doing for the least of these among us?
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And for us, it's the inherent worth and dignity of every person. So you can go down the list as unlivable base wage. Does that help the inherent worth and dignity of every person? I don't think so.
David, you know you got that.
But don't tax anyone. Yes. Right, David? Don't tax.
Let's go over. Dean here has a question.
I did a symposium last fall that included Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel. They're from North Minneapolis, and their organization is called From Death to Life. And I shook hands with a murderer. O'Shea killed somebody when he was 16, and it was Mary Johnson's son. And they've reconciled, and they go out together and talk about forgiveness.
It's amazing.
But O'Shea talked about the fact he's 30 years old. He said, I'm not the same person I was. Mm-hmm. And since I got out of jail, I've only been able to find part-time jobs. And he said it's really, really hard for anybody with any sort of record to get work. And so I'm kind of wondering if there's anything on the horizon, because he said people in my position end up going back to picking up a gun. And I know there's efforts going against gun violence, but is there an effort to hire or find employment for ex-cons In my tradition, Jesus said, I was in prison and you did not visit me. And really what's happened is we don't visit them after they get out of prison. So the felony voting is an issue, but also employment for ex-cons and really
and housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mark Brown, talk about that program here.
Right.
Yes, Michael.
when Father speaks, we all genuflect and do what he says.
Well, you know, let me just say a couple of things. I think that I personally do some work, some group facilitation, and also some life coaching with men coming home from corrections, trying to help them to transition to find housing, employment, and other resources that are needed, and it's a tough uphill battle, for sure it is. And I think that hearing what you're saying, I know that to be true from just personal experience. In terms of you know these kinds of social issues, and I think this is part of really what the work of people in communities of faith that should be about. We should be looking at the issues of today, applying our traditions to that and how we are to make a change. So, for example, and you can talk to it a little bit more specifically, but there's a housing initiative, you know, related to housing. Those coming home with criminal backgrounds, very difficult to find housing, good, decent, affordable housing on top of employment. So that if you can get in, you can't pay for it. You know, and if you could pay for it, perhaps you might be able to get in. It's a chicken and the egg situation. Very, very difficult circumstances that we find ourselves in.
Tim?
Yeah, picking up on what Makram said, our two congregations, Plymouth Congregation and Westminster Presbyterian, are now collaborating precisely on this question.
Sure.
We're in effect shopping for a site to locate, working with Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative, to locate housing for people coming out of incarceration. It'll be housing that we will put forth dollars to provide the private equity, which will leverage, we hope, public sources to establish affordable housing, supportive housing for those being released from prison in mm-hmm. our community.
Great, Michael.
On the north side, there's an organization called Summit Academy. And I was at their graduation earlier this week, and they graduated 180 men and women of color. Many of those folks are just out of prison. It's a vo-tech sort of a training. It goes into the construction trades and into the med-tech medical field. And they also network people for housing. And they have all kinds of strong enculturation programs. So Summit Academy is doing an excellent job on that on the north side.
Great.
And I would like to add one more thing. Our congregation formed a committee on racial and economic justice, and I'm a permission-giving leader and pastor, and part of that is a learning pastor, mm-hmm. and we were fortunate to have Professor Nakimi Levy-Pounds mm-hmm. from St. Thomas Law School, who specializes in racial justice, lead this committee, be a part of our church. Because she's on the teaching team, she's enabled us to tell stories about Ban the Box, mm-hmm. which is a big law mm-hmm. now that allows those with incarceration to have work opportunities without being immediately removed. We had an exhibit that was funded by a Bush grant, foundation mm-hmm. grant, called Everyone is a Criminal, mm-hmm. which is a very intriguing conversation when you have this display in the hallways of people who actually didn't get a record telling their story of the saying they should have gotten a record mm-hmm. and how we need to rethink incarceration and then actually talking about sentencing and watching movies and storytelling such that we understand the issues so that when a partnership comes along that actually creates brick and mortar to change it or the employment opportunities come along, we as a congregation of several hundred people can advocate for a different way of thinking about it that actually improves people's lives and makes America mm-hmm. safer because people are more productive.
We're just about to the end of our time. There is a question here, and there were several others that we did not get to, and they're all wonderful, and I apologize to the questioners whose questions we didn't speak to. But there is one that asks whether our faith communities interact at the membership level. We all get along. That's great. It's wonderful. But what about you know, between the memberships of our congregations. I don't know if any of you want to.
I don't get any members from them.
No. No. Actually,
we get members from you, however.
No, you don't.
Last summer, when our congregation had to do some work in our sanctuary, Temple Israel generously offered their worship space for us to use on Sunday mornings for the summer months. And all of our members came back with one thing that they said. Their pews are much more comfortable than ours. So you should get some of our people for at least that.
Yeah. Well, I think seriously that we do need to think about the fact that 10 o'clock on Sunday morning is still the most segregated time in America. And how do we break out of that? And one of the ways we do that is cooperation, right? One of the ways we do it is cooperating
with each other.
We're not in the pews attending. No, you're not. How did I forget that?
That's why we could give it to Plymouth. Yeah.
I would say, frankly, this is one of the weaknesses of what we're doing here.
Yeah.
You've hit a vulnerable point when you, we talk about this. We've talked about this for years. And we do in sort of project basis. We have a lot of collaboration. Mm-hmm. I've been in instances where there's been some folks, Makram, we've had some of his folks over for a meal at our place, but it's not been organized well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a shortcoming of our group, frankly. We like it because it's just us and we can hang out together and we're friends, but that kind of excludes. And especially with this, you know, just senior clergy, it's sort of elitist as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Michael.
I would like to maybe argue a little bit the other way, that for over 20 years, all of us and those who preceded us have been appearing in each other's pulpits, and we did another series for a long time up until 2 years ago, right before Thanksgiving. What's the point? I think there's unique buzz in this city and has been for 20 years. It goes around water coolers down where people work and out in the community where people from our congregations have seen other people and they talk about it. They talk about this. Mm-hmm. You know, this is symbolic for what they hope religious people do.
Right.
Well, so, my husband is a state representative and he does, of course, door knocking around election time, and he always says that I have more name recognition from all of these congregations than he does, because they see me in very public ways. So again,
in the Christian tradition, we believe that the realm of God, the kingdom of God, however you describe it, is both here now and yet is coming. I think that's true about this. There is this buzz, and I think there is something, but there is also a long way to go for us in terms of building comity and a comity and connection between our congregations. Thank you for that question, but thank you for being here tonight, because this is part of how we bring our congregations together. I hope you'll talk to one another as you leave tonight. Come back for the future things that are coming up. Next one is in June. Join us. Call any of us or email us with ideas, questions in the meantime, because it's about all of us. It really isn't about just this group. It's about all of us. So thank you for your attention tonight.
Tell your friends for June. Bring friends next time.
What's that?
They should bring friends.